Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy live at the library tomorrow. I thought we were at the library now. We're not. Streaming at youtube.com/GBH News. We're joined now by food policy analyst, multiple James Beard winner, Corby Kummer. Corby is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at the Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Hello, hey. Corby. So we're going to start out with a clip from Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s announcement yesterday, where he plans to get rid of all artificial dyes from food and drinks by the end of next year.
A food dye is just a no-brainer. Nobody wants to eat petroleum. Everybody knows there's enough science out there that we know it's terrible for you. A healthy person has 1,000 dreams. The sick person only has one. And right now, there's 60% of the people in this country who have only one dream, that they can make it through a day without pain, with energy. We are going to change that for our country.
I don't know if food dyes will solve all your health problems, but he's right about, since other countries don't allow a lot of these things, we should be getting rid of these food dyes, shouldn't we?
Yeah, I'm happy to see us get rid of food dyes that Europe has been banning in favor of this ridiculous loophole that's been going on with the Food and Drug Administration since the 1960s, especially from the mid-1980s, in self-declaring what's generally recognized as safe or grass. And the industry saying, we think it's fine, we're putting it into our products, come after us if you don't like it, we've told you it's fine. So Kennedy is saying, well, there's ambiguous science. The FDA has been saying for years these dyes haven't been proven to be bad. What lots of U.S. advocates and RFK Jr. have been saying is, yeah, but if Europe has decided they're bad, why are we saying they're fine? So, okay, it's great to be synchronizing in the rest of the world. It's good for industry. They hate reformulating. They're not happy about this because it's not going to make Mountain Dew or Doritos or Fruit Loops look as pretty and bright as they were before, but what they do like is consistency. It's important to say that RFK Jr. said he'd come to an agreement with the eight largest food companies, but those food companies haven't said independently, we're fine with this.
Yeah, usually they protest big time. Their lobbyists get the government to change their mind on these things. Isn't that what historically happens?
It's not even a ban yet. It's just an agreement that they should be voluntarily doing in the next few years. So we have to see what they're doing. But RFK is getting ahead and announcing and saying, I've talked to them all, and they're going to be fine with it. We'll see if they are fine with it. But what industry wants is consistency. What they don't want is state-by-state bans.
Which is why they may honor the agreement, so to speak, right?
And by the way,
it would be great if they honor these agreements.
We should point out in this piece of The Atlantic, I mean, obviously other people have said this too, that synthetic food dyes can be linked to things like inattentiveness, hyperactivity, restlessness in certain children, neurobehavioral effects, not in all children, but in lots of children. And boy, we do have an epidemic of ADHD, don't we? Maybe it is to do with this.
Oops, we lost you there.
I'm right here. Absolutely right. Completely agree.
So can we continue? Let's call this part of our segment, Even a Blind Squirrel, talking about RFK Jr., because he's also right on something else, but it seems to me that this is going to be a lot. This is not intended as the pun it is. This is a much tougher nut to crack, so to speak. Very clever, Jim. Thank you.
Very clever.
Ultra-processed foods. We've talked a lot about the subject matter with you. We haven't talked much about the fact that he appears to be hell-bent on getting rid of them. And it seems to me there are two problems. One, it's not 100% clear all the time what fits into that undesirable category. Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. And two, he's going to encounter much more of a fight from lots of places, including even some places like schools, right, which are dependent upon cheap, ultra-processed foods to feed their kids. Is that a fair statement?
Ultra-processed food are a big, thorny problem that we'll be talking about again and again, and that's fine. There's no agreed upon definition. It's sort of standing in for things that are really high in sodium and sugar and stuff we should not be having. And lots of artificial ingredients we don't want in our own bodies or our children's bodies. What Dan Giusti, fantastic chef who worked in world-famous restaurants and then decided, I'm going to start Brigade, B-R-I-G-A-I-D, helping to put in from-scratch meals in school systems all over the country, starting in Southern Connecticut and New York State. He had an op-ed just now in Civil Eats and saying, to keep to the one-half reimbursement rate that school breakfasts get from lunch, and I believe Dan Giusti and many others, we need to be feeding children breakfast. Often all they will eat are cereals. Cereals are lumped in ultra-processed food. It's going to be harder and harder for schools that aren't equipped for non-ultra processed, for four-scratch cooking. We can't do this without the so-called ultra processed food. So what are we going to do when we want to give children school breakfast? Until we can get the equipment in to these schools in order to give them from scratch cooking, which we all believe in, we can't be throwing out the baby with the bathwater with ultra processed food. This is definitely a problem.
You know, one of the points that's raised in this piece is a lot of critics of this say, defenders of it, is it's very hard to get kids to eat, school kids to eat healthy food. But haven't we discussed with you a million times that healthy, well-prepared food, once kids are exposed to it more than a few times, I don't know what the critical number is, 8 or 9 times or something, they become as enamored of those things as they were enamored of crap, right? Isn't that true?
It's not so much enamored, it's dependent on.
Okay.
It's what can they do in order to be able to feed children.
Okay we're talking to Corby Kummer.
Natural food is not always better, apparently, even we think it is, and it's not?
No, natural food can have, you know, beef tallow. It can be plenty of fats that aren't particularly
sugar.
Good for us. It depends on what the natural food is. What we want is unprocessed food like nuts, like seeds. There are plenty of things, but natural is not necessarily better for you. And so there's a funny column, a good column by Tamara Haspel in the Washington Post about saying natural doesn't always mean better, but because we don't like ultra-processed, we're using these things to stand in for lots of foods that are high in artificial ingredients, high in synthesized chemicals, high in sodium and sugar, stuff we don't want. Natural is lower in them. But natural doesn't necessarily mean better or healthy. Raw milk is natural, and it's likely to make you sick. It's really problematic. And so natural doesn't always mean better.
When you said what we really want are nuts and seeds, what seeds do we want? I mean, what I can't
pumpkin
think of
seeds.
The last seed I ate that made me happy. What is a typical seed experience, Corby?
Pumpkin seeds.
Exactly.
Never had a pumpkin seed my whole life.
Oh, yes, you have.
No, I have
pumpkin
not.
Seeds
me,
are wonderful.
They're everywhere.
Sunflower seeds are wonderful.
Sunflower seeds, that's another good
they're
one.
Not, that's not that good. The little
they're
tiny
good.
Things. You got to eat like 1,000 of them.
You put them
it's
in
like
your
krill
salad.
For a whale.
You put them in your salad.
You do?
Listen,
yes.
If you had trail mix, if you had granola, you've had seeds in them.
I have.
That's right.
I have.
Yeah, pumpkin seeds are all the trail mix. That's a great example.
Okay, now, there's speaking of
krill for a whale.
I said that. I just said krill for a whale. No, and that's what, like krill. Like krill comes in. Krill, yeah. You know what size krill is? Like microscopic.
Tiny, but they have a big mouth. They can eat a lot of it.
Well, they eat a lot of krill.
That's
okay,
right.
So that was my point. Not very well taken, though. So there's another wonderful story in Civil Eats that I think a number of people might dismiss until they read on. It's a story about free grocery stores. And
yeah.
I fear that if you don't read through, people are going to say, well, there are a lot of places that provide free food for people in need. So what's the big deal? This is a big deal. Tell us about it, and how widespread are these kinds of places?
So it's a new kind of food pantry. So food pantries are different from food banks. They get food from food banks, but what they are is like little mini grocery stores. And this was a terrific place that partnered with the Baltimore Public Libraries. You know, public libraries have reinvented themselves. They're wonderful job resources. In this case,
some have radio shows in them. It's incredible.
Absolutely.
That's right.
So, Go ahead.
There are cafes in them. Here was a sunny, bright cafe, kind of like at the BPL. And once a month, it becomes a food pantry that goes in and it sets up very appealing places that take out the stigma of getting free food. No one has to show any kind of qualification for getting this free food. There's a handful of them in the U.S., but the idea is we're giving you food and dry goods, also detergents and things that people get from supermarkets, and we're going to make it a pleasant, stigma-free experience in a bright, sunny room that we'll do once a month. You know, food pantries, I'm in my food is medicine work at Aspen Food and Society, I'm now getting very involved with food pantries and recognizing how essential they are for communities, because they'll open in small places in very convenient locations in a community. And it isn't, they don't have the big logistical problems of food banks, which are fabulous things in themselves, but food pantries are just a wonderful, there's thousands of them in the U.S. They're underfunded the way they always are, but this is a case of making food and groceries available free in an appealing location in public libraries.
So is this happening anywhere in our neck of the woods here? Because I'm not familiar with it.
I looked for this long article in Civil Eats, and there were California. It mostly focused on Baltimore, but I didn't see any Nashville, Chicago, San Francisco, but I didn't see anything. So I hope that Bostonians will read this article in Civil Eats about these new food pantries and say, we can do this in Boston too.
I love this idea. I think it's terrific. We're talking to Corby Comer.
You know, we've heard a lot about the soybean farmers out in the Midwest and how they're freaked out about the tariffs with China because they sell so many of their soybeans there. This was a local story out of the Globe by John Gove, talking about how these federal cuts in funding that go to schools and nonprofits and regional food distributors are going to take a toll on the farmers here because those are the places the farmers sell their stuff to.
It's all over the country. It's infuriating. The USDA cut off billions of dollars that Vilsack, under the former secretary, had made available to get locally grown food into schools. And so the defense of the current administration is they can still get produce, they'll just buy it cheaper. What does buying cheaper mean? It's nothing like local. Already the USDA had a local definition of within 400 miles. In Massachusetts, it's usually within two towns. It's very small farms. They can't afford to undersell the big national distributors. And so what it means is schools who want to demonstrate what produce is like in a local community, grown on local farms, can't show their students, yes, this is what local means. What's worse is farmers who were getting, you know, $200,000 to $300,000 a year, that can be a huge part of their annual income and can help keep them alive from these USDA funds. They've been cut off. It was a terrific story by Gove or Gov in the Boston Globe. But I see this happening throughout the country because of these big USDA programs that were discontinued. The administration said this was during COVID. This was to help others. We don't need them anymore. You can buy national distributed cheap produce.
Okay, so Marjorie, when we were preparing for the show today, said, I want to discuss Meghan Markle right away with Corby. And I said, we have to act responsibly for 15 minutes, and then we can discuss Meghan Markle. So
yeah,
we have a little sound here. Here's the sound, right?
Yeah, here's the sound from Inside Edition covering this critical story about Meghan Markle's raspberry, don't call it jam, which is apparently another log on the fiery feud between her and the firm.
We're in the midst of a royal jam war. Meghan's father-in-law, King Charles, has been quietly running his own jam business for the past 15 years. First up, King Charles's fruit preserves.
Yeah, this is very good.
Then, Meghan's raspberry spread.
It's very tart, and no, I'm not a fan.
So it won some kind of blind taste test, this raspberry jam scam, or I shouldn't say scam, a thing that she's the, you tasted any of, what is she, the Duchess of something or other?
Sussex or something.
Whatever.
Duchess of Sussex.
Tasted any of her stuff there,
that's
Corby
right.
Comer?
No. I have tasted almost all the products of so-called Duchy originals, which were King Charles's, then Prince Charles. I visited the farm
in
Cornwall.
Not.
I interviewed the farmer and built the business model for it. It was a way of making money from his inherited land in Cornwall and also using sustainable and regenerative farming methods to help make a profit. They make really good oat biscuits. Dutchie originals that have been available in markets, really not just Whole Foods, but lots of U.S. markets. For years, they were very interested in building a business. I don't recall tasting any jams. This is a new California-based business that's part of Meghan Markle's branding and new TV specials about lifestyle and how gracious she is. The Washington Post did a very funny tasting. It wasn't the clip you just showed. Very well organized, and Trader Joe's came in number two, right under Meghan Markle's, and the tasters, you know, there were three pastry chefs in Washington. It was blind. They weren't necessarily predisposed to like it. Who knows if they're anti-royalist or they don't like Meghan, but they said, you know, it's really good. It's perfectly fine, and it's got very fancy boxing. It's not a good bargain per ounce, and it's hard to get, but they liked it. So I think it's great.
It's great. Now, I went to her website. Her company, her food thing, is called As Ever, E-V-E-R, and I went to the so-called store online because I was going to buy Marjorie something because, as you know, she's a big fan of the monarchy and ex-monarchy in this particular case.
Yeah.
Do you know what the status of every single food item on her website was, Corby Comer?
Sold out, I bet.
Sold out,
yeah.
Exactly. Every day. From honey with wildflower honey with honeycombs, $28. Flour sprinkles, not F-L-O-U-R, F-L-O-W-E-R. What are flour sprinkles, and what do you do with them? What do you do with them? Hello?
You say they look pretty, and you get bragging rights for saying this is Meghan Markle's Prince Harry's wife.
$15.
People are into her and Harry. You know,
what
they
do you
got
mean
that
people
TV.
Are into her? What are you?
Well, she's got the TV show, and they kind of got trashed by some, but apparently it's got decent ratings. I haven't checked this week.
I don't
maybe,
think so. Is
maybe
that
it's
true?
Not doing that well.
I'm sure Corby is watching. You watching the thing, whatever it is that they're doing
every
there?
Every minute wrapped.
I know you were. You know, okay. Can we spend the next few minutes on somebody who I'm afraid much of our audience hasn't heard of?
Too young.
I am a huge and have been a huge fan for virtually my whole adult life. This particular gentleman, who Corby's going to describe to us, has just celebrated his 97th birthday. We're going to play a song from him in a minute. Tell us who Tom Lehrer is there, Corby Comer.
He's about the most brilliant and funny man who ever lived.
I agree with
and
that.
He lives in Cambridge, and he went to my high school and graduated at 15 and went to Harvard, and like he was done by the age of 18 or 19. His first love was mathematics, and he taught at MIT, at Wellesley, and then UC Santa Cruz for many years, spending about half a year in Cambridge. But in the 60s, he made an international career, still a cult figure for probably the funniest songs written by an American humorist, not just satirist, but humorist, incredibly perceptive, sharp, and funny. And many people, including young people, including Daniel Radcliffe, know his songs by heart and go on talk shows and sing his song, The Elements. They're wildly clever.
Well, we have one here. Here's a clip of Tom Lehrer's song from 1959, and it's called We Will All Go Together When We Go. Here he is.
And we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go. All suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go.
He was and is great. How is he, by the way, Corby Comer?
Fantastically sharp, with the most incredible memory and a sense of humor and dry wit and brilliance, and he titles emails Still Not Dead.
That's a riot.
That's pretty good. And is your connection the high school thing, or is it more contemporary? What's your connection?
No, it's part that we had a very strong mutual friend who was his neighbor and very close friend and invited him over for holidays. And it's just one of the most fortunate things in my life that I got to meet him.
Well, speaking of fortunate things, well, I can't disclose the name before you go. Marjorie and I spent the afternoon with a very prominent Bostonian the other day, whose name we can't mention.
We did?
Who said to us in the middle of our afternoon together, having a drink or two and some other things, that her favorite guest on this particular show, Boston Public Radio, do you know who her favorite guest was? Corby Cummer. Yes. One of the most respected people in our community. We just can't say who it is because we didn't get her permission.
Oh.
But trust me, Marjorie has no idea who I'm talking about. And she was there. This is like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Right.
Well, I'll share it with both of you at some point in the future. Hey, Corby, wish Tom Lehrer our best. And please tell him that we are huge, huge admirers of his brilliant work. We're pretty fond of yours, too. Take care of yourself, Corby. See you soon.
From everyone. Thank you so much.
Corby.
See you. Take care.
We've been speaking with food policy analyst, multiple James Beard winner, Corby Cummer, executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Coming up after noon news.